Not those lions. Three lions we can get behind.
And he hoofed it.
There's more pressure being ratcheted up with a loss like that, of course.
Just getting the head boxed off, should that just kind of happen.
For all your Lions coverage this summer, download the OTB Sports app.
You're welcome on. Great show for you this evening, if I do say so, on the football show. Gab Mercati is going to join us. He'll give us the Italian perspective on Sunday night. He'll talk Mancini, Vialli. He'll tell us about the transformation in Chiellini, the person. Plus, Gab was at Wembley on Sunday evening and has very strong thoughts on the security issues. After Gab, around 9:30 or so, Marcela Mora Iorahu on a first international trophy for Lionel Messi, 16 years on from his Argentinian debut. 8 o'clock, Dermot Leese with us ahead of the British Open at Royal St George's. And David Law will join us as well this evening, tennis commentator with BBC Five Live. He'll give us his perspective on Wimbledon just gone. 53106 is the text number. We are at Off the Ball on Twitter. Novak Djokovic obviously winning his 20th Grand Slam. So it means out of the last 71 Grand Slams, Djokovic, Federer, and Nadal account for 60 of them. All three are tied on 20 apiece. Matt Slater is going to join us as well this hour and give us his take on the damage done to England, and I suppose by extension, we're in it with them, Ireland's World Cup bid. Richie McCormack, hello.
We're all amigos, Joe.
A great bunch to be in with. Dave McIntyre, how you doing?
Evening, lads, how you doing?
Very well. So lots going on, Dave. Obviously extraordinary scenes on Sunday evening. There was the match, and then there was the, well, it seems just chaos at Wembley. It turns out increasingly, as journalists get to grip with the story, that we're now talking thousands having made their way into Wembley, not just hundreds, without tickets.
Imagine you're one of those people who's paid a fortune for their European Championship final ticket and you have nowhere to sit. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine the anger there, particularly if you've got children with you and they've nowhere to sit and you've got yobs in your seat. And I did read and heard a couple of times people referring to the how early the Luke Shaw goal was scored, and that actually went an awful long way to diffusing some of the animosity that was in and around the stadium, particularly in those areas that fans had invaded, ticketless fans had invaded, and that had Italy scored early, perhaps, that maybe things really would have boiled over actually internally in the stadium. But the stuff that we saw outside was just unbelievable. And I had a lot of friends who were, yeah, as we all did during the week, discussing, certainly once they beat the Danes, well, will you be happy enough to see England win on Sunday night? Will you be supporting England? Will you be vociferously supporting the Italians? An awful lot of them were very much in the Italian corner, if they hadn't been already, once they saw what had gone on in the 2 or 3 hours before kickoff. It was just sickening to watch, but not altogether surprising either, was it?
No. It's just so irritating that the yobs can hijack it. The worst kind of football supporters hijack it and are allowed to hijack it, and the majority just have to put up with it. And that seems to be the deal with football, or English football, for far too long.
Yeah, well, that's the real key to it, isn't it? They are allowed to do it. I would imagine in many other countries in Europe, you step out of line to that extent, and I would be surprised if it did happen, because you know what the deterrents are, you know what the consequences would be. But B, if it does actually come to pass, that it's met with such force that it would discourage anyone from ever going down that route again. And yet there seemed to be no real prediction that this could take place. The security was weak, to say the least. I felt so sorry for stewards trying to police that area. I mean, these guys are probably on minimum wage, having to deal with those sort of people coming straight at them with absolutely no care for their welfare. It's an awful position for those people to be in. I don't know, will there be a review done into the security measures taken, but all of it will have a long-term effect on this World Cup bid in 2030. Do we really want to be involved with something like that?
Yes. No. I was reading Miguel Delaney's piece. One family said they left after half an hour because their children were petrified, was in his piece. I mean, that's when England are 1-0 up and on the cusp of winning the Euros. So if you're leaving then and you've paid a lot of money for your ticket, we're talking thousands in a lot of instances, then you can imagine just how petrified they may have been. And Gab Marcotti, who's on later on and is brilliant on a whole range of things, we chatted to him before coming on air. He was talking to his friends. Gab was at the game as well, but his friends were there, and they were a family and had some kids, and they turned up at their seats, and you see there were staggered entry times, so that was to keep people apart, because, you know, there is this small thing called COVID still knocking around, and it is most certainly knocking around in the UK. So they arrived at their designated time and got to their four seats, and there were four lads in the four seats, and they told the family pretty much where to go. And there just didn't seem to be anything you could do about it. I mean, you could go to the young steward who was getting minimum wage and tell them, but generally the stewards were saying, oh yeah, look, we'll try to do something about that. But tough luck was the general assessment. And I suppose, Richie, they're just quite lucky that this wasn't a capacity crowd invited to Wembley, that there were spare seats to go to. Now it seems they're all crammed together, and who knows if this is one great big super spreader event. We'll find out in the coming days. But if there weren't those spare seats or spare areas to go to, then this would have got extremely ugly, you suspect. And I think that reality is only becoming apparent in a very real way in the last maybe 24 hours or so, as people get to grips with the numbers.
Yeah, luckily it hasn't actually proved completely catastrophic in terms of injuries and deaths and all that kind of stuff. But just to give people a scale of what they were looking at on Sunday evening, if you recall the match and the way we look at the tunnel side of Wembley, if you recall to the left-hand side as we look at it, there was no aisles visible throughout the entire bottom tier as we looked at it across the pitch. They were all taken up essentially by people who either didn't have tickets or were forced out of their seats and forced to find a different vantage point in the stadium. There was a very serious policing and stewarding failure at Wembley. The common thread throughout a lot of the pieces, throughout Miguel's and through a lot of the English hacks over the course of the last 48 hours, has been the sheer lack of police presence in and around both London as a whole and then Wembley especially. There were several journalists I read on the over the course of the night and then subsequently yesterday and indeed today, said they didn't see, they barely saw any police officers whatsoever in and around the ground, which for an event of that scale, even with reduced capacity, seems mind-boggling that, you know, that many people were allowed to break. You know, we've all been at major sporting events and different matches and all that kind of stuff. There's no way in a lot of them that you'd get absolutely anywhere near. But this seems to have been something that's been building. I read a few reports today from fans who'd made it to the FA Cup final, and the fan numbers for that were again drastically reduced to what we saw on Sunday. But even then, they said the checking and the scanning of various checks for COVID and then your tickets, of course, as well, were really, really slack. So it seems to have been something, unfortunately, that has been coming at Wembley and will need to be addressed fairly quickly. And what they're going to find today, if the UEFA do decide to pursue this to the fullest extent, we saw what happened with the Hungarian fans, the fact that Hungary now have a two-game spectator ban. England could find themselves being handed something pretty similar by UEFA, given all that went on across the entirety of Sunday.
Yeah, I guess they'll live and shrug their shoulders, and a few qualifiers won't hurt them overly. But yeah, UEFA are within the rights to take action against the FA. So Gamarcotti on the way, he was fairly livid about the situation. I mean, further to your point, Rich, about the police presence, the thing is, Dave, from before lunchtime, I would have said, on all our phones over here, it was fairly apparent that London was in an interesting place. There were drinks being had and white powdery substances being taken in full view, and Leicester Square was in an interesting state very early on. And if I was Home Secretary, or if I was the head of Met Police, I would have thought to myself, we'll just check our security situation, because it feels like we're bubbling away here, and give this 5, 6, 7 hours. But that doesn't seem to have happened either.
No, clearly hasn't. Whether that was the policy, whether that was a strategy they were undertaking to the day, you know, a softly approach in the hope that maybe if you keep your priest presence slightly visible, but certainly not overpowering, that maybe things won't boil over. And maybe bar that one incident, the police might say things didn't boil over. But it was a pretty large, sizable incident, and there were people injured trying to get through those gates, people caught on them. There was one guy that was been treated by paramedics, the way to the right of the picture as you were watching that footage unfold. And they'll definitely have to review it. Like, if they received a fine because there was a laser shone into the eyes of the Danish goalkeeper, Kasper Schmeichel, by one fan, well, how will they look upon what happened with hundreds of fans in the build-up to the game? Like, I'm actually sick and tired of talking about it. It's such an irritating, annoying subject, and it's something that was so incredibly predictable. And I don't think that whatever punishment is meted out, it's going to have any real effect on these thugs. That, like, I did see today somebody saying that, you know, they should be banned from ever attending a football match in England for the rest of their lives. I mean, systematically, the amount of CCTV footage that should be there, we're in and around the stadium and on streets and police cameras and everything. You should be able to weed out every single one of these and ensure that they can never buy a season ticket or even a match day ticket to a game ever again. I mean, that would certainly affect those people, you would imagine, whether they're Old Trafford season ticket holders or they go and watch Darlington or Rochdale on a weekly basis. But are they going to go to the effort and the trouble of doing that? Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows? I'm kind of amazed in hindsight that it didn't all kick off after they lost. That's the kind of surprise. I don't quite know why that didn't happen. I was fully expecting it.
There's a really good piece, Joe, by Jonathan Lowe today in The Guardian on that very subject, and that all of the anarchy and all of the supposed lawlessness took place before the game. Afterwards, England was just a tired, litter-strewn, semi-emotional place. That everything they had invested in the game had actually been invested in the 2 hours before kickoff.
I read that all right. I mean, it was beautifully written and interesting, but it still didn't answer the question fully to me. You know, I'm still surprised. Like, I thought we'd have stories on Monday of Italian takeaways and eateries being smashed in and all that kind of stuff. It didn't seem to happen for
That shows the general thought around English support and how they're held, I guess, not only within their own country, but obviously around the world as well. And that impacts on ourselves if we are going to go ahead with this 2030 World Cup bid, which I think is foolish in the extreme, because like you can talk about it being a great boon to the economy should have come to pass, but you look what's going to happen in, was it 2026 when the North American World Cup happens? Like, the England, if this does come to pass, is going to get the bulk of the games, by far the bulk of the games. Mm-hmm. And we'll get one or two in terms of venues. But it's not worth the investment to go that far down the road for a bid that everybody seems to be sure is going to go to Portugal and Spain anyway. And to just be dragged in with that kind of behavior and to be grouped with that kind of behavior when we're the antithesis of that and have been for the last 30 odd years, it just doesn't seem to make any sense from a political capital point of view or indeed a financial point of view.
Well, surely we'd get the final now. That's the upside. We'd definitely get the final. I don't know. It's just, it was like Sunday was kind of a microcosm of life. So many instances in your life where at events, the annoying types ruin it for everyone. You know, I think that's what jumped out to me as well. Why are these idiots allowed to ruin it for so many others who are just there to have a good time in a semi-normal way? And yet it's always just certain types which kick off. And I don't know. We'll talk to Matt Slater, 7:30. Gab Marcotti's on with us after 9. He's really annoyed. He kind of got me more annoyed. I was kind of thinking, look, these things happen. And then the way Gab described the whole situation, and you'll hear it after 9 o'clock, kind of got me a bit outraged as well. So that's on the way. We should start the news round, which is, as ever, with thanks to Gillette, put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. So domestic football here, Richie, European action for Shamrock Rovers.
Yeah, Stephen Bradley hasn't abandoned hope of his Shamrock Rovers side making it through to the second qualifying round of the Champions League. The trail Slovan Bratislava by 2-0 going into tonight's second leg at Talis Stadium, where 1,500 fans will be waiting for them. Swiss side Young Boys await the winners of that tie, but no Irish team has ever overturned a 2-0 first leg deficit in Europe. Kickoff is at 8, a pretty attacking side from Bradley tonight. He's named the likes of Ronan Finn, Richie Towell, Danny Mandrew, Rory Gaffney and Graham Burke in a 3-5-2 formation, as I say, kickoff at 8 o'clock. Elsewhere, Linfield must overturn a 3-1 first leg deficit at home to Zalgiris Vilnius. And there's a 5:45 start in Oswestry, where it's Newtown 0, Dundalk 1 in the second leg of their Conference League qualifier. Dundalk now leading by 5-0. Michael Duffy scored that goal for the Lilywhites 5 minutes after the restart. Should mention as well, both of those sides, Dundalk and Rovers, handed first division opposition in the first round of the FAI Cup, with Dundalk having to take on Treaty United, and Shamrock Rovers will be at home to Galway United, both those ties being played towards the end of this month. UEFA has opened disciplinary proceedings again regarding England's fans' behaviour around Sunday's Euro 2020 final. Hundreds, if not thousands, stormed the stadium without tickets, and an inspector has been directed to investigate that matter specifically. The FA has also been charged with disturbances during the Italian anthem, a pitch invasion and the throwing of objects, as well as the lighting of fireworks. Martin Lipton joined the lads on this morning's OTB AM and described what he saw on the night.
Is there a long-term damage to any potential bid by the fact that ticketless fans were able to access the European Championship finals?
Well, if there is, then the South American bid must be destroyed because of the damage caused before the Copa Libertadores final the other year. Money talks, finances talk. The issue is, does a British Isles bid get the support of Seferin and UEFA over the Spanish-Portuguese bid? If not, it doesn't matter anyhow. If so, then they've got a chance. Unless they decide to ignore UEFA and plea to Infantino and get his support because the South American bid doesn't win. And also, if China bid, China win anyhow, so it won't matter.
So you don't think this has any political ramifications?
I don't think it helps. I think the images of Sunday afternoon and Sunday morning, in fact, the whole night, were despicable, disgusting, outrageous, a slur, a genuine badge of shame for the country. And I mean that. Those what I witnessed on television was utterly beyond belief. It was so bad. What I speaking to people who were there and listening to them, it was probably even worse if you were in it. It was disgusting, and it's a shame. It was shameful. But unfortunately, we're not the only country which has shameful acts perpetrated by some small number of individuals. The worry, I guess, is that there were too many of them. The policing was woefully, and the stewarding and the ticketing and the organisation was also woefully inadequate. That is not in any way meant to justify or condone, because I would like every single one of those people to be banned from anywhere near a football stadium for the rest of their lives. I really would. Unfortunately, I don't have that power.
Do you think that will happen? Because the outrage is... Look,
well, there's CCTV. They should be able to identify them.
Yeah, a lot of CCTV.
And they'll know if they had a ticket or not, because they have a database of ticket holders. So anyone they can identify who went into that stadium clearly didn't have a ticket, or who they know clearly didn't have a ticket, they should be able to try and identify, and then the court should come in and ban them. Now, legally, I think they're only allowed to ban for 3 years, but I think you can always rush through emergency legislation.
Now, Richie, British Open week.
Yeah, defending champion Shane Lowry will be among the earlier starters on the opening day of this week's Open. The 2019 winner will play alongside US Open champion John Rahm and the former Open champion Louis Westhuizen for the first two rounds at Royal St. George's. They tee off at 10 a.m. on Thursday morning. Rory McIlroy goes out at 3 o'clock on Thursday afternoon, along with former Masters champ Patrick Reed and Cameron Smith, while two-time Open champion Padraig Harrington has Brad Kennedy, the Australian, and qualifier Sam Forgan in his group. They tee off just before 1, while 2011 champion Darren Clarke goes out at 8:30 in the morning with Bernd Wiesberger and the amateur Joe Long. Meanwhile, Brooks Koepka says he'd relish the chance to play alongside Bryson DeChambeau for Sunday's final round. The pair have been involved in a long-running and public spat, which Koepka says dates back to the Northern Trust in August of 2019.
Yeah, he didn't like that I had mentioned his name in slow play. So we had a conversation in the locker room, and then I guess... You know, he said something else in the press conference, but didn't mention his name in it. And he walked up to Ricky, said something. It was, you know, you tell your man if he's got something to say, say it to myself. Thought that was ironic because he went straight to Ricky. So I had a few, Ricky told me when I came out, hit a few putts and then just walked right over to him. We had a conversation. Both agreed we'd leave each other out of it, and then wouldn't mention each other. Just kind of let it die off. Wouldn't mention each other's names. Just go about it. And so then he decided I guess he was going on that little whatever, playing video games online or whatever, and brought my name up and said a few things. So that was fair game.
I mean, he can say whatever he wants. I think he said something about lack of Liberty National not upholding something. I don't know what he's talking about in that regard. Maybe that's on me. Maybe I didn't. I really don't remember anything about that. We just had a conversation that, I really don't know what happened, because we haven't really bantered back and forth until now. So it's like, why is that happening now? Anyway, besides that, I'm here to just play golf and focus on that. If we want to keep bantering back and forth, obviously being respectful and having, you know, keeping lines where they aren't getting crossed. Yeah, I think it's fun, good environment for people out in golf.
Oh, dear. Just keep bantering. Dave, this should be an interesting Open. So Royal St. George's in Kent, it has the reputation of being quirky. Maybe that's a euphemism. I mean, luck can definitely play a part here. A lot of fairways with fairway mounds. You get some mad bounces. The first hole often talked about in that respect, the 17th. Jack Nicklaus, who didn't like it, Dermot Cleese would explain more after 8 o'clock, but Nicklaus said it was the only place he played where you could hit the middle of the fairway and lose your ball. And I suppose that's borne out by the results in the last two occasions. Darren Clarke, 2011, was like a 200-to-1 shot, talented player that he obviously is, but he was, you know, was not expected to win there. And then particularly 03, Ben Curtis, 396th in the world, won here. So this is not a tournament to get too crazy about a favourite. Strange things can happen at Royal St. George's.
Yeah, I mean, that's before you even take into account the weather. And I'm not quite as clued into it this week in terms of the build-up as you probably are, Joe. I mean, have you looked at the weather forecast and whether one side of the draw is particularly favoured than the other?
Not to that extent, but the weather's actually meant to be okay as the week goes on.
Okay. Yeah, well, I do remember 2011, and there was a couple of insane bounces that went Darren Clark's way in the back line in particular. Did he vault two bunkers where he he didn't exactly get the connection he was hoping for of some long-range approaches into a couple of the greens in the last couple of hours? And look, in particular when you're going for your first major, you do need a little bit of luck here and there. From my memory of Ben Curtis's win is that he was rock solid. And obviously helped by an issue in a bunker in the 17th with Thomas Bjorn, but that Ben Curtis absolutely deserved his Open Championship in the manner in which he managed to finish that out. A guy that, as you say, no one had ever heard of it, and it came out on the heels of Todd Hamilton's win a couple of years prior to that, or his was the year after that, in fact, in 2004. So there was that weird spell in the Open Championship where really anyone could go out and win it. But it's still very hard to look beyond the favourites. I was taken by John Rahm so soon after winning the US Open, the amount of birdies he made in Scotland at the weekend, and bar one or two poor shots on his inward nine at the weekend, he could have won that tournament. And given what he's done in the Irish Open at links courses in the past, it's really difficult to look beyond him, particularly as if you say, we'll have a closer look at it in the days to come, but that the weather isn't going to be playing a massive part this weekend. There are blind shots, and I know that Brooks Koepka isn't overly taken by that. Who is? I don't know of anybody that enjoys hitting a shot in golf and having no idea when you've hit it to the right spot or not until someone finds your ball for you. But it might lend to a couple of interesting moments on the back nine on Sunday evening.
Yeah, Dermot Galease on the way after 8 o'clock. Loads to talk about there. Rory McIlroy says he found something on Sunday, by the way, in his swing. So he's suddenly feeling pretty confident, amongst other things. Richie, thank you for including some golf in the news round on this last major week of the year. Appreciate that.
Nice to give the minority sports a nod, Joe. You know yourself.
Well, indeed, indeed. Golf Weekly, by the way, bumper preview pod tomorrow. We'll have a watch along Sunday and review pod on Monday as well. So get over to Patreon and search Golf Weekly if you want to join us. Meanwhile, the cricket, Rich.
Yeah, brilliant result for Ireland today. They've beaten South Africa by 43 runs in their second one-day international in Malahide. The first was, of course, rained off at the weekend. A century from captain Andy Balbirnie helped the hosts put on a score of 290 for 5 from their 50 overs. Harry Tector also added 79. Well, George Dockerill scored what proved to be a rather useful 45. Josh Little, Mark Adair and Andy McBrien each took a pair of wickets as Ireland bowled out the visitors for 247, and the sides will meet again come this Friday. Eric Lowndes has become the latest Dublin player to step away from the county senior football panel. The St. Peregrine's clubman departs with 7 All-Ireland medals to his name. Lowndes made his decision known to Desi Farrell's management team ahead of their Leinster quarter-final with Wexford. Despite featuring in 4 league games this year, Farrell has fitness concerns over a number of key defenders ahead of Sunday's semi-final with Meath in Leinster, and that's not been made any easier, of course, by Lowndes' departure.
Mm. Dave, how vulnerable do you think Dublin are this year?
It's very difficult to say off the back of one game, albeit a game in which they certainly didn't pull any trees up, but they have never had to deal with the level of departures and injury issues and off-field topics as they have done in 2021, starting with the training sessions in Ishvales, the situation around Stephen Cluxon, which astonishes me. My mind boggles as to how Desi Farrell is unable to categorically tell us in July, in the middle of a Leinster Championship, whether or not Stephen Cluxon is going to be playing with Dublin this year. I do not know how that situation has been allowed come to pass, and there's absolutely no way this would have occurred when Jim Gavin was in charge. And then just the sheer list of guys who've walked away, the experienced guys who've walked away through retirement, and the likes of Keane O'Sullivan and Paddy Andrews and Dermot Connolly, and then you've injuries to Small and Cooper and Merchant and McDade. Lowndes, the latest guy to wave goodbye to the panel today. No McCaffrey, no Mannion. A long answer to a short question, I think they're as vulnerable as they have been at any stage since 2010.
Yeah, I think that's about as far as any of us can go. I'm not sure if that's very vulnerable or kind of vulnerable or a little bit vulnerable, but I think that's about the best way to put it. Fellas, we're out of time, unfortunately. Richie McCormack, thanks as ever.
Cheers, Joe.
Dave McIntyre, pleasure.
Thanks, guys.
Now, competition time. We're giving you the chance to win a life-changing sum of money here in News Talk. €20,000, no less. It could be yours this Friday. All you have to do is tell us, where are the 2020 Olympic Games being held? A, Tokyo. B, Hong Kong. Text the word play, followed by A or B, and send it in to 57599. Entries cost €2.50. You must be 18 or over to enter. We're running this right across the Go Loud network. You'll find full terms and conditions on newstalk.com. Get your entry in by 3 o'clock this Friday, and we could be calling you to give you the 20k on Friday evening, which would be a nice start to the weekend, I dare say. So best of luck with that. We have Dermot Galease after 8. Busy football show. Gab Marcotti in really interesting, good, strong form after nine, and Marcela Moura-Iorahu as well on Messi's win. But up next, Matt Slater is going to join us as the fallout continues after scenes at Wembley.